This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville. 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and I'm your host, Matt Schaefer-Powell. In 2006, Tennessee voters were asked if the state constitution should limit the definition of marriage to a union between a man and a woman. It wasn't even close. More than 81% of voters said yes, and what was known as the Tennessee Marriage Protection Amendment became a part of the state constitution. By the time Sophie Justy and Val Tanko moved to Tennessee 6 years later, public attitudes about same-sex marriage like theirs had shifted somewhat. Polls suggested Americans were beginning to accept the idea. In that spirit, Tanko and Justy joined three other gay couples and launched a legal challenge against the amendment, specifically the part of the amendment that gives the state the authority to disregard their marriage. As they sit here with me today, along with their attorney, Regina Lambert, they're anxiously awaiting a decision from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, one of the country's highest courts. Val Tanko, Sophie Justy, and Regina Lambert are our guests today on Dialogue. In a few minutes, we'll open up the phones for your questions. And in the meantime, thanks to all three of you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to actually start the show by reading the verbiage of the state constitution. This is not the entire constitution, just Article 11, Section 18. And this is how it reads. The historical institution and legal contract solemnizing the relationship of one man and one woman shall be the only legally recognized marital contract in this state. Any policy or law or judicial interpretation purporting to define marriage as anything other than the historical institution and legal contract between one man and one woman is contrary to the public policy of this state and shall be void and unenforceable in Tennessee. If another state or foreign jurisdiction issues a license for persons to marry, and if such marriage is prohibited in this state by the provisions of this section, then the marriage shall be void and unenforceable in this state. I want to ask all three of you what goes through your mind when you hear that or when you've read that in the past. And let's start with Regina.
Well, I think that it's must be a difficult thing for anyone who has gone through the experience of being able to marry a loved one and then realize that a state that they either live in or visit is willing to say that that relationship and that marriage, that commitment is void and unenforceable. I think that for anyone who had the happiness and the joy and the ability to meet, to find a loved one and to make a life commitment, that it's stunning to hear that that's a void relationship to as far as their state is concerned.
And Regina, were you living in Tennessee in 2006?
I was.
You were. So you remember when that election took place, the amendment won?
I do.
Yeah. Sophie, how about you? What goes through your mind when you either hear that or read that?
Yeah, I agree with Regina. I think that the verbiage is fairly harsh. The word void and unenforceable, I think, is pretty harsh verbiage. So obviously it doesn't make me feel good as someone who considers myself married. It happens to be to a woman. But to recognize that that's what the state of Tennessee thinks of our marriage is obviously upsetting.
And Val?
Yes, I definitely agree with both Regina and Sophie. And personally, to me, it also is referencing my family, not just our marriage, but the validity of our family, which luckily now includes a beautiful little girl.
Right, right. And we're going to talk about Amelia at some point during the show, too. I know you're both very proud of her. Let's start kind of from the beginning. Val and Sophie, where did you meet? What were the circumstances?
We met at the University of Cornell in 2009.
It runs together after
right.
a while.
Right. After a while, it's all. In 2009, and we were both studying there at the time, and we ran into each other in an elevator, mm-hmm. and the rest is history, really. We started dating a few months after.
And then you got married in 2011. That was just a couple months after the state of New York had changed its law. Is it something that you had talked about for a long time, about getting married, having a legal ceremony?
Yeah, I think that we had a vision from when we started dating of being together forever, a long time, and having a family together. And then, as you alluded to, in I think it was June of that year, maybe, that New York State recognized gay marriage.
Cuomo.
And so, yeah, Governor Cuomo, yeah. And it wasn't long after that that we decided to get married. It was always on our horizon, and obviously it depended on where we were. But being in New York at the time that passed through was a perfect place to do it, and we never hesitated.
But at some point you moved to Tennessee.
We did.
And I don't think I pointed it out this out yet, but you both teach at the UT Vet School.
That's correct.
And what were the circumstances that brought you to Tennessee?
So we had been, you know, we're both academicians, so we both work at a university and are professors, and it's really hard nowadays, even just in private practice, to find jobs together in the same location.
And then the fact that you're not only, I mean, that might be the case if one of you is teaching English,
exactly.
And one of you is, but for you both to be teaching in the same sort of a vocation, probably makes it that much more difficult.
Yeah, that much more difficult. And so we knew we were going to face that challenge once we were both done with our education at Cornell. And UT offered us a wonderful opportunity to hire both of us as a spousal hire, which is when one of the spouses is hired, and then because they want them to come, the other one is also offered a job. Mm-hmm. And the UT Vet School was able to do that for us. And we had actually been living apart, quite apart, New York to Calgary, Canada, mm-hmm. for quite a while. So we tried, and UT offered us the opportunity to live together in the same city and get started on our family.
You must have done your research before you came to Tennessee, mm-hmm. and you were familiar, maybe not, you didn't know that it was Article 11, Section 18, but you knew that it was part of what kinds of conversations did you have regarding that?
You know, I think at the time, yes, you're absolutely right that we knew that when we moved, our marriage would no longer be recognized. It wouldn't be recognized by the state of Tennessee. We were aware of that. And as Val said, the decision to move was because, you know, when people do things, they weigh a whole bunch of factors. And for us, the jobs were just too good to turn down, and the feeling from the vet school was too good to turn down. So professionally, we had made the decision to move, and we knew that personally it was going to affect us moving from somewhere that recognized our marriage to somewhere that didn't. But I have to say that at the time, both being adults, it was something that we could forego, that we could consider giving up, at least in the short term. You know, later when we started to really think about having a family and when Val got pregnant, that's when it became much more, I think, important to us to try and figure out how to get our family recognized the way other families are recognized legally. But at the time that we moved, like I say, just being the two of us then, it wasn't quite as poignant as it became later.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mentioned at the open of the show that when Amendment 1 was on the ballot in 2006, it passed with more than 81% of the vote. Did you know that before you moved to Tennessee? I mean, would that have enforced maybe some of your concerns about being in a state like Tennessee?
We didn't know the number 81%. It's an astounding majority. We didn't know that number. To tell you the truth, it would not have changed our minds. We had heard that Knoxville was one of a few cities in Tennessee that was large enough to just naturally have some diversity in it. Our experience, obviously, had been with the vet school, in which they had been very open to having a same-sex spousal hire. And so I think with that information, the number 81% wasn't going to make us not move here. Mm-hmm. But it is an astounding majority, for sure.
You've both gone from having a relatively quiet, happy existence, happy marriage, to being very visible in this. In this debate, in this conversation, what has that been like for you to step out into the spotlight like that?
Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, you're doing a lot of interviews. You're in the newspaper. People are saying things positive and negative about you.
Mm-hmm. You know, the one thing that we keep saying is that we're lucky, in the sense that we have a very supportive environment, both in our family life and in our work environment. And given that situation, we thought, when presented with the opportunity, that it was the right thing to do, that we were lucky enough to have a solid support system around us, and that a lot of people don't have that. And although they would like for them to be recognized and their families recognized, as hopefully ours will, they can't step out into the spotlight that way, either because they're scared of being fired or they're scared of some family retaliation. So when Regina presented us with the opportunity of becoming part of this lawsuit, we really took little time to think about it and accepted, even though we are quite reserved and quiet.
Yeah, yeah. And Regina, that's a good part of the conversation to bring you in, because you approached Val and Sophie about it.
Yeah. I did.
How did that happen? I mean, how did you learn about them, and what made you think these two would be perfect plaintiffs in this lawsuit?
Well, actually, it wasn't until the Windsor decision came out June 26th of 2013, just over a year ago.
And just for those who may not automatically jump in their mind, the Windsor decision was...
That's the Supreme Court decision that struck down a portion of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. There was a case, E.D. Windsor, and they acknowledged that it was unconstitutional to not recognize her marriage as it affected, at that time, IRS issues. She was taxed a substantial amount of money when her 40-plus year partner died. That would have been a zero had their marriage been recognized as the state of New York did. And that had a huge impact on all of the marriage equality litigation since then, because the Supreme Court acknowledged that there was dignitary rights, and they talked about the children of these relationships and the humiliation that they could face. And so it really opened up a wide door, as we've all seen over the last year. When I became involved shortly after that case, I was out of the country on the 26th and came back and read everything I could get my hands on. And mm-hmm. Abby Rubenfeld, who is one of the attorneys involved in the case, had been quoted in the Tennessean that she was going to be filing a suit. And we were in contact with each other and sort of started putting this case together. Other outside counsel, the National Center for Lesbian Rights out of California, became involved. And then we've been incredibly fortunate. Sherrard & Roe, a law firm in Nashville, Bill Harbison, who is actually president-elect of the Tennessee Bar Association, became involved. And Maureen Holland from Memphis. We wanted to have a case where all of the major cities across the state were represented mm-hmm. and have plaintiffs from all three. And I think because we were in the South, we made a decision that rather than have a full challenge to Tennessee's ban, we were going to start off with a recognition case where we would find plaintiffs who had been legally married and recognized in another state and for whatever reason relocated.
Which is essentially, when I was reading the way it appears in the Constitution, that section of the Constitution, it's the last sentence.
Correct.
Essentially. Yeah.
Correct.
That says that if you have your marriage may be legally recognized somewhere else, but just not here.
Correct. Yeah. And so when we started to talk about plaintiffs and look for plaintiffs, it was really easy for me to find people and know people who were Tennessee residents who left the state to marry and came back. But what we wanted to focus on were people who had these legitimate recognized marriages and had the benefit of living in a place that respected and acknowledged that marriage. And so I had met Sophie and Val through some friends, through a veterinary friend, and really there weren't that many folks that I personally knew of who had relocated. And I thought they would, just knowing them and I talked with them about it. It really isn't the kind of thing that you want to talk someone into, because mm-hmm. it's daunting and
you're
exposing your personal life. And I think that it was just a very brave, courageous decision on their part. And they've been fantastic as far as their ability to communicate, the dignity that they have. We didn't know at the time when we first talked that a baby would be involved this early, but I suspected that, I knew that they had future plans, that they were going to have a family.
Well, we are going to take a quick break here on Dialogue. We are talking with Val Tanko, Sophie Justy, and Regina Lambert. Together, they're challenging the validity of Article 11, Section 18 of the Tennessee State Constitution. That's a section that defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman. If you have a question, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or you can call us the old-fashioned way, 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, back with my guests Sophie Justy, Val Tanko, and their attorney Regina Lambert. Justy and Tanko are plaintiffs in a lawsuit that's challenging Tennessee's gay marriage law. If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter, on Facebook, or by calling us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And just before the break, Regina, we were talking about the specifics of this case, that you're not necessarily with this challenge, you're not challenging the entire, all the provisions of this section of the Constitution, but specifically with the one in which the state has the authority to disregard marriages like Val and Sophie's. What was the idea behind just challenging that part of it?
Well, I think it was because we're in a southern state. It was one of the first lawsuits post-Windsor we filed in October. And I think that it was maybe an easier baby step. We had a two-step sort of two-phase plan of bringing this initial recognition-only case and then following up with a challenge to the full state, the ban in the state. Before we got there, so many other states have become involved. And so we really are at a place where we had this pregnant plaintiff, and we filed for a preliminary injunction requesting that the state recognize the marriages of our six plaintiffs, the three couples, during the pendency of the final outcome. Mm-hmm. Judge Chauger, we filed in the Middle District in Nashville, in Tennessee, and she granted that in March, just within a couple of weeks.
Did you expect to get that injunction? Because a lot of times there will be filings for injunctions. Did you expect that would go in your favor?
We were very hopeful. Yeah. And at that point, there had been several cases that were starting to trickle out through the different states where the federal district courts were finding the similar bans unconstitutional. So there was a real hope there. Mm-hmm. The timing couldn't have been better because for Sophie and Val, I can't imagine getting ready to start to give birth to a child and not knowing if there could potentially be a complication and whether or not your relationship would be recognized or not. So it was, I'm sure, took a huge load of stress and worry from their shoulders, and so that they could enjoy that time.
I want to go back to that, because that's an important part of this case, really, is the fact that Val was pregnant and you were able to get that injunction. Let's go to the phones real quickly. Samantha is calling from Knoxville. Samantha, welcome to Dialogue.
Hi.
Hi there. You're on the air.
Well, I just had a quick question. I'm a resident of Knoxville, and I wanted to see what just a normal resident could do to help you guys with anything like a case like this.
Oh, that's a great question. Anybody want to jump in?
Samantha, thank you for that comment. I think that what we've seen, when you mentioned earlier, Matt mentioned earlier, this 81% from the constitutional amendment in 2004, it is so different from the responses that we've seen across the community of just an incredible amount of support and encouragement for both Sophie and Val and myself. I think letting folks know that that's what you think, sharing those thoughts, talking to people and encouraging conversations, because a lot of times folks who are hesitant or uncomfortable with the topic, it's because they're unfamiliar with it or because they don't have they haven't had the opportunity to be educated on what that means and what type of people. I think that's where, you know, next week, I think, is National Coming Out Week. And it's fascinating to me as a person who's just turned a 51. I said that on, oh my goodness.
it's out there now.
Yes, there you go. But who spent a good 30 years kind of through this process. And it's just, I think, through people knowing people and asking questions and learning, it's not such a different. People aren't so different as you might would expect them to be.
And that number 81 is sort of shocking in a certain. It's a large number. I would have to imagine that if they had a similar amendment right now, that even if it passed, it wouldn't be, by 81%. I mean, do you both feel that way?
You know, Matt, it's been, and it gives me goosebumps because it's been nothing but a, luckily for us, a great experience. And people like Samantha, you know, asking us what they can do. And just by coming up to us and telling us, hey, I saw you on the news. I, you know, I'm so, thank you for what you're doing. That has brought me to tears more than once. And that support is invaluable. So, you know, it hasn't been, at least not to our faces, it hasn't been anything but a supportive place to really.
So you haven't gotten a lot of face-to-face negative sort of confrontation.
Luckily not.
No, not face-to-face.
No. But people have written things about you. And
yeah.
Is that
never read the comments.
Yeah, the comments.
The comments, yeah.
The comments below the articles that have been in the news can be very, very biting.
Yeah.
Really, really hard to read. And so I was given the advice, which I now follow every single time, to just not read those comments. Mm-hmm. Our experience, as Val was saying, has really been overwhelmingly positive. So many people nowadays, it's just become in the last, you know, certainly since Windsor in the summer of 2013, but for a few years before that, where in other states same-sex equality was passing, it's just such a different issue now than it was when that vote was taken. And I have no doubt that if that vote were to come up again, that the number would be reduced. Now, I don't know whether it would be enough to actually pass, you know, or not, but for sure it would be reduced from 81%. There's no doubt about it.
It certainly doesn't reflect the experiences
yeah.
of people.
Yeah, that was actually my next question. I was going to say, yeah. does that 81 it reflect the experiences that you've had since you moved to Tennessee?
Not at all.
One of our first experiences, we went out to dinner here in Knoxville, and one of the first times we ever went out to dinner, and we ran into a couple, an older couple, that, you know, clearly had identified us as a couple, mm-hmm. And actually invited us to have dinner with them. And I'm not even kidding. And we were like, okay, I guess Southern hospitality is.
There you go.
So that was our very first experience, you know, and with just random people, and it's just been that way since mm-hmm. we've gotten here.
Regina, if you could kind of define where we are in terms of the process, and also something I want to clarify, there are other lawsuits in Tennessee, correct? And if you can sort of differentiate between this particular lawsuit and some of the other legal action that's taking place.
Sure. First, I'll speak to the federal lawsuit, which is the lawsuit that Sophie and Val are plaintiffs in. That lawsuit, we do not have a decision on the merits of that case at this point. What happened is when we filed for that preliminary injunction, Judge Chagger granted that. And then the state requested a stay from the Sixth Circuit, which was granted. In the meantime, the other four, we have four states in our circuit. The Sixth Circuit is the appellate court that oversees the federal district courts from Ohio, Kentucky, Michigan, and Tennessee.
And as you're listening to the news, quite often you'll hear referred to the Sixth Circuit Court in Cincinnati, which
is where it
meets.
It's located in Cincinnati, Ohio. And so what happened that was very unique with our circuit is that all four states had litigation pending, some more advanced than us. Michigan and Kentucky both have full equality cases where the federal district judges have found that their state bans are unconstitutional. Ohio had an issue that had to do with death certificates and birth certificates, and we had the preliminary injunction. Everything was in front of the Sixth Circuit, and what they decided to do, which was unprecedented, is they combined them all, and we all had oral arguments on one day. It was in August on the 6th, and the three-judge panel heard back-to-back arguments from, there were six different cases from the four different states. And we expect that they'll issue their ruling anytime, really.
This could happen any minute.
Right.
And I asked you before the show, Regina, to turn your phone off.
Yes.
And we're hoping that it doesn't happen in the next, say, half an hour.
No.
But, yeah, that ruling from the Sixth Circuit Court could come down at any time.
Correct.
How are you feeling about it?
It's very difficult.
I know.
To ask
an attorney.
Well, I think that I listened to the 10th. The 10th Circuit had two oral arguments, and the 4th Circuit and the 7th. So we're the fourth appellate court that's looking at this. And you get a feeling sort of one way or another when you listen to the questions that the panel of judges ask. this case was very different. The Sixth Circuit was very different. You had a real Judge Sutton will most likely be a swing vote on the decision one way or another. And he asked questions. He was very prepared and he was very thoughtful about the issue, but you couldn't get a feel for either side. When he asked questions of the state, he acknowledged that, you know, they talked about state justifications for and rationales. He acknowledged that they were weak at best, and he talked about the democratic process. So there's really no way that I would put a penny on how the outcome will be. And then Justice Ginsburg in the last couple of weeks was speaking at the University of Minnesota Law School, and it put an even greater focus on the Sixth Circuit because she commented that if you want to see what the Supreme Court, or if you want an idea of what the Supreme Court may do this term, look to the Sixth Circuit.
And what does she mean by that?
Well, what she means is at this point, every circuit court, every appellate court has ruled in the same way. So there's been no split. And if the Sixth Circuit, if we should lose at the Sixth Circuit, then that will be the first court of appeals that has come out in a way other than the other appellate courts, which would make a split in the appellate courts and make it probably inevitable that the court would take a case this term.
So I don't want to mischaracterize that, but if you were to lose this case in the Sixth Circuit Court, it actually would have the benefit of going to the Supreme Court.
Correct. Now, the Supreme Court could take a case even if the Sixth Circuit ruled in our favor. And there's been a lot of governors, a lot of amicus briefs where people are asking the Supreme Court to take a case regardless because there's such a patchwork right now and there's such a unknowingness. There's a lot of opinions that are stayed. So there's more than 10 states that are affected right now that are sort of in a limbo. And I think that everyone hopes that they would take a case, I think even from both sides, just so that there can be some finality and some understanding of where to move forward from there. But I think that if the Sixth does rule in favor of the states, it will be the first appellate court that's done so, and that would make it so the Supremes would very likely take a case this term if they won't anyway.
974-5050, 974-5050. If you'd like to ask a question of our guests, we have Regina Lambert, Sophie Justy, and Val Tanko here in the studio. And let's go to Jenny, who's calling from Knoxville. Jenny, you're on Dialogue. Welcome to Dialogue.
Hello. My question is for Sophie and Val. You said that you guys were able to move to Tennessee because of the jobs you were offered, which was due to a spousal referral. So I find that interesting that UT, which is a state institution, would recognize your marriage, but within a state that doesn't recognize your marriage. So
yeah.
was that an encouragement to you to move here despite the laws? And has UT been supportive of you since you've come and since you've become a part of this case?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jenny, because it's really interesting that that we got such support from the vet school. I think it was very much at a local level that they made the decision to hire both of us, one of us as a spousal hire, in which the university state politics never came into play. It was, like I said, a very local level decision in the vet school for what was best for the vet school at the time. But it did give us a lot of positive feelings about both the University of Tennessee moving to Knoxville and certainly our work environment. And I think honestly that a lot of people in the University of Tennessee system would be supportive of same-sex marriage. But you're absolutely right in pointing out that ultimately it is a state school that has to abide by the rules, the laws of the state of Tennessee. So, for example, even though the vet school hired us as a primary and then a spousal hire, we couldn't, for example, get on a family health care insurance because that was dictated by the state of Tennessee that our marriage wasn't to be recognized. So I think it's just a difference between, like I said, sort of what the vet school could do within its own walls versus what the entire university has to abide by. But it definitely made us feel better about coming down into Knoxville and also certainly about our work environment. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's part of the reflection of the disconnect between the laws currently and what we actually live every day. That support, like I said before, which is just not reflected by our legal system right now.
You know, I would have to say, though, that it's one thing for them to hire a same-sex couple and offer that spousal benefit, but to for you to have become very, very visible, once, as I mentioned before, mm-hmm. have they been supportive about that, about your being involved in the case and in being out there as much as you have been?
Again, at a local level at the vet school, the answer is a resounding yes. Mm-hmm. We did meet with our department chair before filing the suit. I'm not sure to ask permission exactly, but at least to give fair warning.
Yeah. Something big is about to happen.
Right. And they have been nothing but supportive of us at the administrative level in the vet school, nothing but supportive of us.
974-5050 is the number to call if you have a question for one of our guests. 974-5050. That's the number Bob called, and Bob is calling from Knoxville. Bob, welcome to Dialogue.
Hi
there. You're on the air.
Okay. I have a question, but I would like to make a brief statement to frame it to make why I'm asking the question.
Sure.
I'm probably the typical person that you would think would be against what you're talking about. I'm a white male, 71 years old, raised a Southern Baptist, relatively conservative politically. Mm-hmm. But I'm not in disagreement with the marriage. I have gay friends, some are married, some are not. And my only issue with it is the fact that it's using the word marriage. And I know it doesn't matter if gay people get married, it doesn't make my marriage any less or not going to hurt anything. I just wondered if they came back with a different term, and it all meant the same thing, but it was different. It meant marriage and a gay relationship. Maybe, is there any such possibility that might make it more acceptable to people?
But and Bob, maybe something like you've heard the term civil union in is that the kind of thing you're thinking about?
Yeah, and I can't come up with any example about why the name bothers me. I like taking gay as a homosexual relationship messes up somewhat what the meaning of gay street is, or so being happy and being gay. It's taking a word and calling it something different. It doesn't really hurt anything. It's just odd.
Okay, Bob, thanks very much for your questions and your comments.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for calling in. We definitely appreciate hearing from you and also appreciate just the idea that you would be supportive of same-sex relationships. And you definitely bring up a question that a lot of people bring up, which is why does the word marriage matter? And I guess I would bring it back to the idea that separate cannot be equal. So, you know, it's been proven over and over again that if you have different terms for something, that ultimately that means that there is a difference. And that might be a legal difference, or you could argue, well, it could be a civil union with all of the rights and responsibilities the same as a marriage. But then in which case, why are you calling it something different? And to call it something different still must mean that somewhere deep inside there is some sort of difference between same-sex marriage and straight marriage. And I think that's what's so important to us about using the same term, because to us it is the same relationship as straight marriages. So it's something that's really important to us that it's not a different term, because, again, this idea that separate is always going to be unequal.
To me, the way I imagine or kind of put that in context is imagining myself explaining to my daughter why our marriage is not called marriage or is called something different than maybe one of her schoolmates' parents' union. And the answer is always, well, if it were called something else, then deep inside there is something different between our family and other families. And I don't think that should be the way things are. Our family is as loving as any other family out there.
I think another important thing, Bob, for now, just in the last really year or so, is that after the United States Supreme Court decision in Windsor last June, it made it so married same-sex couples they qualify for federal benefits now, regardless of whether their state has marriage equality or not. So as long as they look to the state of of celebration, which means where you got married, as opposed to your state of residency. So in situations now where people are married in a marriage equality state and then live in a state like Tennessee that does not recognize same-sex marriage, they still are eligible for over 1,000 federal benefits. And the federal government doesn't allow those benefits for civil unions. So it really kind of changed the dialogue as far as civil unions versus actual marriage. Even in states that had civil unions, they're likely going to have to convert those, and many already have, to marriages so that those citizens will be eligible for those federal benefits that are now available.
We are going to take a real quick break here on Dialogue. Our guests in the studio are Val Tanco, Sophie Justy, and Regina Lambert. Together, they're challenging the validity of Article 11, Section 18 of the Tennessee State Constitution. That's the section that defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman. If you have a question, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or just call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, back with my guests, Sophie Justy, Val Tanco, and their attorney, Regina Lambert. Justy and Tanco are plaintiffs in a lawsuit that's challenging Tennessee's gay marriage law. If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter, on Facebook, or by calling us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. That's the number Jim called. And Jim, welcome to Dialogue.
Yes, I had just a few comments. Bill Buckley once said, well, the only alternative to majority rule is rule by the minority. And, of course, this case was going to be passed and approved by a minority of judges. They're not elected and so on and so forth. The consequences say, oh, it doesn't matter. They do what we want, and so we – in fact, the word minority doesn't mean anything. So then what actually happened was politically, people got mad. They couldn't get at the judges, but they wiped out a whole bunch of fine Democrats to the point where Arkansas, Tennessee, and Texas, Democratic parties reach out of business. But anyway, the other thing about it is that the income tax, it started out in the income tax states, where the states had high income tax. Well, if we can get our partnership approved as a marriage, they would give you a deduction. So it was a money voter. I'm an economist, and 90% of the drive behind human activity is how to improve their standard of living. And then I guess my question is, why isn't so many cases, as you turn the TV will be on and gay marriage gets passed someplace, and I don't see anybody under 30. In fact, a whole bunch of them are over 40. So to some extent, what's going on here? Why are these people, marriage, of course, is 21, 22. It used to be.
Okay. Well, Jim.
Anyway, ask us some of those questions. Thank
okay,
you.
Jim. Thanks very much for your question, and actually, a couple different questions in there. Let's take the age one first. I mean, I don't know if I'm certainly not going to ask anybody their ages. although Regina's already revealed her age.
I can speak to one thing, Jim, that I think will help to clarify a little bit. Is that really until the last decade, there was not even an opportunity for people to get married. So I think what you see a lot of times and what you read about and what gets focused on are couples who've been together for 20, 30, 40 years getting married because they couldn't have gotten married before that. So I think a lot of these initial marriages and people who really didn't have to take a whole lot of time to think about it, they've been a couple for a decade or two or three or four. Mm-hmm. And so and I guess other than that, it's just that, you know, gay people are very much like their counterpart straight friends, and married people, a lot of folks tend to wait a little bit longer to get married. It's not as, you know, when my parents were young, getting married in your late teens, early 20s, a lot of people choose to wait to get married and start a family till they're, I guess, 30s or have their educations, you know, underway or graduated.
Yeah, I think that's just a shift of overall marriage, not just gay marriage.
Okay. Jim was talking also about sort of the origins of some of these gay marriage bans. And it brought up a question that I wanted to ask you, Regina, is wasn't the fact that this was a constitutional amendment, wasn't that on a certain level supposed to make that bulletproof?
Well, I think that the the issue that's happening with so many states where these constitutional amendments are being found to be unconstitutional are because even when you have an election and a constitutional amendment that passes based on a majority election, they still have to be in line with the federal constitution.
Because the federal constitution is, by its own definition, the law of the land.
That's correct, yeah. And it trumps. And so when a state has an amendment that is later found to be in violation of the federal constitution, then it will have to be disbanded. It's not going to be effective, and it's not going to be able to stand.
974-5050, 974-5050, and I think we're going to Nancy, who's calling from Knoxville, or are we going to Betsy, who's calling from Newport?
Hello,
is this Betsy?
Yes, this is Betsy.
Hey, Betsy, you're on the air. Welcome to Dialogue.
Hi. First of all, I want to say I think the ladies are fabulous and are doing something that is groundbreaking and so necessary.
Thank you, Betsy.
I really
admire
them for what they're doing. And I do have a question. Have you all considered doing a corporate status thing to where you have like a PC or an LLC, which you can protect yourself legally, without the benefit of the legal marriage thing beforehand, so everything is taken care of. Should anything happen, you know, especially now that you are have children. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Betsy. I hadn't heard of that before. Is that something that's kind of been out there?
So I'm not quite sure about what she's saying about the corporate definition, but I can tell you that we tried to do everything in our choices and mm-hmm. possibilities to protect ourselves and our family, like living wills and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, that's something that can be challenged if something were to happen to one of us. And so we're not protected under the umbrella of the law. And I think probably Regina can talk a little bit more about, you know, what we can or what you can sign before that it's just never going to be the same as the.
It's not seamless.
Yeah. And yeah. It also costs quite a bit of money to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Vel makes a good point is that couples can try to legally set themselves up as to be as safe and protected as possible through powers of attorney and living wills and wills. But ultimately, you can't get a legal recognition, yeah. And you can't get state and federal benefits absent. The legal recognition of a marital relationship.
I want to make sure, because we've only got about 10 more minutes left in the show, but I want to make sure that we address your favorite topic, which is Amelia.
that is our favorite topic.
Tell us about Amelia.
Oh, Amelia. She, my voice gets trembly because she is the light of our lives. I think any parent would say that.
How old is she now?
She is now 6 months and 3 days. 4 days? 4 days.
But who's counting, right?
No one.
Yeah. What do you hope someday Amelia will be old enough to read about this, hear about this? What do you hope she says or thinks when she sees what her moms did?
Oh, you know, we'll just be the embarrassing parents. But
you're probably right about that.
But ultimately, I just hope that it makes her proud. That's my ultimate hope.
Regina, the fact that Amelia is part of there's a legal aspect to this too, and I'll let you tell the story to how we got here. But Val and Sophie are the only lesbian couple in the state of Tennessee to have both their names on the birth certificate, on Amelia's birth certificate. So if you could, Regina, tell us how we got to that point.
Well, it was really just the Judge Chagger issued the preliminary injunction within, was it 10 days, I think, of Amelia's birth. So what that did was it required the state of Tennessee to recognize the marriages of the three couples, the six plaintiffs in our case. So, of course, Sophie and Val's marriage then was required by the state, but Judge Chagger required the state to recognize their marriage. In the state of Tennessee, we have a presumption of parentage when you have a child who is conceived through artificial means. And so when Amelia was born, because their marriage was to be acknowledged and recognized, then the other parent, the spouse, was also got the benefit of that presumption of parentage. So on the birth certificate, both parents got to be listed as Amelia's parents, which is really a wonderful thing. I think sometimes people think about, when you talk about a marriage equality, the benefits of marriage, but there's also responsibilities of marriage. Mm-hmm. And sure. And I think that's one thing that is very important when you think about families with couples with children. Not only does that child have the benefit of the dignity and the respect and having a family unit like everyone else's, but also that child is protected. If one of the parents should die, you have Social Security benefits for both. If there should be a split up of the parents, then you have child support issues. So there are some it's not just a situation when you talk about marriage that's beneficial to everyone. It also has responsibilities included, and these are responsibilities that people want and are more than willing to take.
At the same time, I mean, I absolutely understand what you're saying. There are a lot of very pragmatic issues here, but it must have been, what was that like, Sophie, that moment when you actually got to write your name on the birth certificate?
Well, it was just an amazing experience. Ginny was with us the day after Amelia was born. We were still in the hospital, and Regina came over to make sure that the paperwork sort of happened in the way that it had to happen. Being that it was the first time, I think there was a little bit of confusion about, you know, various things. So the three of us were there on day one, and seeing that birth certificate, or knowing that it was going through at the end of the day, was just really such a monumental relief to me. As Ginny said, it's not just the rights that I want, it's the responsibilities of being a parent to Amelia. And so just getting that, I think it was just an amazing, amazing experience. There's no doubt. It was an amazing day anyway, obviously.
Yeah, right. Go ahead, Val.
Oh, it was just great when we actually got the birth certificate in the mail. I couldn't stop looking at it. Of course, I cried, but, you know, that seems to be hormonal.
Let's see if we can squeeze one more call in. Nancy's calling from Knoxville. Nancy, welcome to Dialogue.
Yes, this is Nancy Mott, and I just, my partner Linda and I just got back from New York City and got married there.
Congratulations.
I'm a deeply religious person, mm-hmm. and one of the things that I think I'd like to see mentioned is that there's often confusion as to the rights of churches who don't agree with gay marriage, as obviously we do. Would they be required to perform marriages? And so I think it's very important to point out, as the amicus curiae that was brought before the Sixth Circuit Court on behalf of many religions that are for gay marriage,
correct,
that it in no way would require that a church that doesn't agree with gay marriage, that they would have to perform same-sex marriages.
Well, thank you, Nancy. Yeah,
and, I'm glad you brought that up, Nancy, because it's very true. And I have even my own family members who I explain this to. But we have a separation of church and state. So we have a secular laws. When we get a marriage license, that marriage license is issued by the state, regardless of where you celebrate your marriage, whether it's at a church or a synagogue or in a park, you still are required by law to have that state-issued marriage license. So absolutely not. There would not be any requirement by any religious organization to conduct a wedding that was in that conflicted with their religious beliefs. This is completely the legal state side of the issuing of the marriage license. So it's the secular side that we're talking about. Although there are many, many religions that are now offering and opening their doors to same-sex marriage, but that's completely up to that organization and to that religion.
Yeah, I just want to say that, Nancy, I'm also a very, very religious person, and so is my family, coming from a South American country, and that has always been an understanding. Even in Argentina, where I'm from, there's marriage equality across the country, and we live by Catholicism as a culture. But it's understood that the rights and to celebrate that marriage is just a matter of legalities. It's not. It has nothing to do with the church.
Sophie, how has this experience changed you, being involved in this lawsuit?
I think it's opened me up a lot. You know, I've always been sort of out, but now we're out in a way, out time to the power of 10. And, you know, I feel very, I guess I feel responsible in some ways for how everything goes. And so I'm always aware of being the face of this lawsuit, at least in the east part of Tennessee. And so there's responsibilities that go along with it. But I also feel very humbled to be a representative for so many people who are asking and wanting equal protection under the law and equal rights. And I think that's what I take away from it the most, is that I'm so thankful to be in this position and hope I'm doing other people proud.
Val, how has it changed you?
Definitely. It's been quite the surprise to be out there and see my face on the front page of the newspaper. But I also hope to be making people proud, and I'm thankful for all your support.
We are out of time here on Dialogue, and I want to thank our guests, Val Tanco, Sophie Justy, and Regina Lambert. Thanks to all of you for coming today. Thanks also to Greg Hill, who ran the board and handled the phones. And thank you for listening and calling and sending us your questions. If you missed the show or you just want to hear it again, we should have it up on our webpage in the next hour or so. Just go to WUOT.org. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville, WUOT HD1 Knoxville, and WUOT.org, listener-supported service of the University of Tennessee.